From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Lately, the media have come under fire from the Pentagon. Hostilities flared late last month when Marine Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold said that the combat forces of the Taliban had been eviscerated. 2 weeks later, that assessment was updated by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who said that the Taliban still had substantial forces. That led reporters to question the probity of the Pentagon and the progress of the war and put the Secretary of Defense on the defensive, as when this week he interrupted this exchange between a reporter and a general.
Yes. General, there have been a few different characterizations of the Taliban combat force strength from this podium. What is your assessment now?
He does not believe they've been eviscerated. Of that, I can assure you.
William Salatin wrote in Slate.com that the media were bad news bearers whose reflexive cynicism and impatience were sapping national morale. In fact, he says, though the media are clearly biased in favor of the American cause, the war coverage slants toward the Taliban.
Well, there are two different questions at stake here. One is who's right and wrong in the war, and the other question is who's winning and who's losing. Now, on the question of who's right or wrong, obviously the American media are sympathetic to the United States and tend to sort of skew their coverage in favor of their own government. On the question of who's winning and losing the war, however, the coverage has been slanted against the United States government in the form of all sorts of not just skepticism, but sort of cynical dismissiveness about our prospects for ever finding Osama bin Laden or defeating the Taliban.
Now, you referred to something called vicarious doubt of reporters and that skews coverage. Isn't it the role of a journalist to be skeptical?
I do think that it's the role of a journalist to be skeptical. My concern is that when you get an entire room full of reporters who are all becoming not just skeptical but cynical about the ability of the United States to ever win the war, not just how it's doing this week but how it might do several months or years from now, that creates a pack mentality and you end up creating a consensus, a zeitgeist, that the war can't be won. One of my favorite words that I hear now a lot is quagmire. Quagmire is this concept that says it's hopeless. Once you go into this war, you'll lose, you'll kill civilians, you won't defeat the enemy. Give up. I mean, that's the implicit message of it.
Would you outline some of the stances that the press has been inclined to take that immediately put the Pentagon on the defensive?
There are several ways in which reporters, while being politically biased in favor of the United States, they construct their coverage so that inadvertently it favors the Taliban. One of the ones that I've noticed most is that we tend to describe ourselves as the subjects of the war. We act, and the Taliban are the objects. They react. Well, you know, superficially, you know, this flatters us because we're the ones in control of the war. But actually what it does is it helps the Taliban because we're constantly supposed to be reevaluating our strategy. We bomb them. If they don't move, if they don't budge, if they don't turn over bin Laden or give up, then maybe we should stop bombing. We never, of course, ask these questions about the Taliban, whether they should rethink their resistance to us in light of the fact that we're bombing the living daylights out of them. So that's one way in which we impair the United States in terms of its morale. Another way is American reporters tend to value American lives more than Afghan lives. If a bunch of people get killed in Afghanistan today, reporters will say, well, that wasn't that many people. You know, we really didn't make much of a dent in the war today. Whereas if there's, you know, a threat of anthrax, not even a real anthrax letter, somewhere in the United States today, there will be headlines and, you know, banners across TV all day and all week. By acting as though even the prospect of one death in the United States is such a huge deal and, you know, 50 Taliban soldiers getting killed in a bombing is no big deal, then in any exchange of casualties, we'll interpret that we lost because that one American life was more valuable than 50 or 100 Afghans.
I mean, I take your point. But the thing is that you've got a bunch of people who are trying to ask the questions and investigate something that they're entirely closed out of.
Here's what I'd advise reporters to do. If the Pentagon stonewalls you, say so. That's your report. You can say, you know, I placed 10 calls today to my sources in the Pentagon and to the official spokespeople. I didn't get my calls returned. You know, I went to the briefing today. A bunch of questions were asked, and anything that was really important, they said, we're not going to discuss operational matters. Just say that. And don't play this game of, you know, they're giving us their spin, so we're going to construct this devil's advocate spin that the war is hopeless and force them to give us some information to the contrary. Because after the TV is turned off, viewers will come away, you know, not with the impression that some facts were not disclosed, but with this impression that every single question that was asked conveys that the war is hopeless and futile.
William Salatin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
William Salatin is a senior writer for Slate.com. E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post. He says the press is getting slammed for negativity that's really coming from another direction.
Well, actually, I think that the toughest attacks on the administration do not come from the press at all. They come from hawkish critics, many of them political conservatives who are sympathetic to President Bush on other matters. In terms of the press, I think the press primarily has been responding to kind of contradictory statements that have come out of the government. In earlier weeks, we were told that we had eviscerated the Taliban's capacity to wage war. And then a couple of weeks later, spokesmen tell us that they're really tough and they're very difficult adversaries. And so I think it was not at all surprising that the press, and for that matter, the public, asked who's on first, what is really going on here.
Well, if that's the case, that it's the policy people and not the press that are truly impatient with and most critical of the war, why have the president and Secretary Rumsfeld gone after the media?
Because it's much easier to go after the media than to go after other critics, especially people who are in many cases in your own party and have supported you on other issues. I don't think anybody ever lost money or votes criticizing journalists.
Do you think that the negative headlines and the doubt-filled questions are an effort by the press to goad the Pentagon into providing more information?
I'm not sure that's true. I think that these headlines grow out of the Pentagon kind of overselling and then having to unsell some of the things they said earlier. And some of these headlines simply reflect the facts on the ground. There were at least some things coming out of the Pentagon that led us to believe that there might be quicker victories on the ground, that the Northern Alliance might be stronger on the ground than it turned out to be, or that our bombing was having more effect than it may have had. Now, I think the proof in the pudding is that the administration really changed its policy over the last week. It really stepped up the bombing. Now, if you talk to some people in the administration, they'll say that was our plan all along and we did this gradually, and maybe that's true. But if you look at what has actually happened, they themselves seem to have altered the policy a bit, and so maybe there has been internal criticism of the policy as well.
Well, E.J. Dionne, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute.
Martin Walker, Chief International Correspondent for United Press International, joins us now. Welcome back to On the Media.
Hello there.
Martin, last week we discussed the Kosovo wobblies, how the European press seemed to be nervous and backing off of its support for the U.S. and the war in Afghanistan. What about public opinion? Have the polls begun to appear in the European papers?
Well, yes, the polls have started to appear, and they're scaring the pants off Europe's political leaders. In France Dimanche, the French Sunday paper, a poll found that only 17% of those questioned thought that Operation Enduring Freedom would end in success. 47% thought it would fail. In Germany, there was a poll reported in Süddeutsche Zeitung, which showed 45% of Germans thinking that the bombing was a mistake and ought to be stopped. In Spain, you've got 54% wanting a bombing pause. That's according to El Mundo. In Italy, according to Il Messaggero, 45% want a pause in the bombing. This sense of real European disquiet has led many newspapers to talk about the loss of the propaganda war, and it's got the European leaders nervous.
Lo and behold, this week, President Jacques Chirac of France and Prime Minister Tony Blair of the United Kingdom came to Washington and stood with the president at the White House to discuss Europe's continued commitment. I gather the press polls and their appearances were not unconnected.
That's right. The polls that were published really alarmed the European leaders, and they took the view at this dinner party that Blair organised at Downing Street on Sunday night that the way to turn around European opinion was to stop this war looking like purely an American operation and for President Bush to overcome the objections of the Pentagon and start accepting these manifold offers of troops. The French have offered 2,000 troops, the Germans have assigned nearly 4,000, the British have already got troops there, the Italians, the Spaniards, the Dutch, they're all offering troops, and the Pentagon is saying, well, we don't actually want the hills of the Hindu Kush reverberating to the sounds of Buongiorno, Guten Morgen, Bonjour. They don't need this Tower of Babel in the military operations. But the Europeans are saying that for political reasons, we really ought to have this.
Now, that's interesting because, at least on this side of the Atlantic, to appease the populace, political leaders tend to say, well, we will not get involved with American troops on the ground. But you're suggesting that by including their own country's troops in this operation in Afghanistan, these leaders are trying to get their citizens behind the war.
Well, absolutely so. And this is the kind of argument that you're reading even in the left-wing press. Take, for example, France's Libération. The urgent and necessary challenge we face is to find bin Laden and his men before they contaminate the whole Muslim world. There is no reason why this challenge should be faced by the United States alone. From the Independent in Britain, a left-of-centre paper, military impatience with the lack of results from so-called pinpoint bombing, the urgency about the approach of winter must not be allowed to weaken the coalition of support behind the ultimate objective. Süddeutsche Zeitung of Munich, a very centrist paper, the reasons speaking in favour of America's right to self-defence and Europe's need to join them have become stronger rather than weaker over the past 4 weeks of war.
Are you reading from anywhere around the world an exception to the rule? Are there places where, in spite of the trends of most of Europe, the press and the citizens seem to be backing away even today?
Well, I think we can sort of cite some of the usual suspects in Greece, which has got a very anti-American tradition in its left-wing press. Eleftheriopita has been warning that the bombardments have not proved effective so far and they will not prove effective to combat terrorism. A country is being destroyed and civilians are being killed. The terrorists do not justify the continuation of the bombardments. You're certainly getting that, but across Europe as a whole, and even in Eastern Europe, what you're getting is a much, much wider sense of solidarity.
I have one further question. Is that the rustling of newspapers I hear, or are the cicadas back?
No, it's the rustling of this pile of newspapers I bring to the studio every week.
Well, thank you, as always, for bringing them along. Martin Walker is the chief international correspondent for United Press International. Martin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, the media diet of an Afghan community and how to pitch patriotism in the land of the free.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Fremont, California is a suburban town between Oakland and San Jose. It's also home to the largest population of Afghan immigrants in the country. Reporter Raquel Maria Dillon went to Fremont to see how the tight immigrant community is processing the events of September 11th. They're doing it with the help of some trusted voices in the media, their own.
Arfa Azizi Kayumi works in the kitchen of Selang Pass Restaurant in the heart of the Fremont neighborhood called Little Kabul. She came to the U.S. only last March. She was an Afghan refugee in Pakistan until she got married to a U.S. citizen and came to Fremont.
My family live in Pakistan. I'm very unhappy because where is the fighting?
Kayumi can't express her feelings in her limited English, so her boss, restaurant manager Wahid Andisha, translates.
She says, we're feeling sorry for all those innocent people that are victim of politics, and Pakistanis and Russians.
Like many, Kayumi first heard about the military bombings in Afghanistan on TV.
Actually, we were watching an Indian channel where suddenly the whole thing changed to showing the American bombarding Afghanistan.
Andisha left Kabul over 20 years ago, built this business, and sent his kids to American schools. But he still dreams of returning to a peaceful Afghanistan someday. He is typical of many Afghans in Fremont who blame the Pakistani government for the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in their homeland.
The information that's in our paper, it doesn't say in American television or radio because you're a close friend of Pakistanis.
The Fremont Afghan community produces and consumes print, broadcast, and web news media. It's in Farsi, Dori, Persian, Pashto, and English. There's a weekly, Omaid, from Virginia, a monthly newsletter, Caravan, published in nearby Alameda, and several websites devoted to Afghan music and culture. Most are produced by former Kabul journalists in their spare time, and most side with the Northern Alliance against the Taliban. Before the recent scrutiny of Afghanistan, Afghan publications and programs were often the only place immigrants could turn to for news of home and for news in general.
سلام های کارکنان آزادی رادیوی افغان ها را خدمت هر یکتان تقدیم
می‌کنم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم و به نستعین و صلی الله تعالی و سلم علی خیر خلقه محمد و علی آله و صحبه.
That's Harun Sameh, a radio producer for Azadi Afghan Radio, which is broadcast in the Bay Area, Washington DC and Los Angeles.
We have been telling the American media over the past 5-6 years that's what was going on in Afghanistan. And nobody ever covered it. So I kind of question their expertise on that.
Sameh says Azadi Radio tries to be objective because there's so much misinformation and rhetoric about Afghanistan.
That's why when we get it from news media, from Reuters or anybody else, we try to confirm it with the locals there. Resistance or the Taliban or from Pakistani sources or directly from American State Department or Defense Ministry personnel.
Other Afghan-American journalists strive towards a different goal.
I really feel that there is a tremendous need for our community to have a voice.
Farida Anwari hosts another weekly radio news magazine called Eternal Images. It features music and recipes as well as news. She wants to keep Afghan culture alive for younger Afghans, the children of the expatriates. And she says it's important to keep recent arrivals and non-English speakers informed.
They are very isolated among themselves, and the majority of the elders don't know that much English to get the information from television and radio. You know, from the radio, we want to give them all kinds of information, first of all.
Whatever it was that mainstream media was not communicating, people now have the technology to create a presence for themselves within the media culture.
Sandy Close runs New California Media, a coalition of over 400 ethnic news organizations from around the state. She says in the so-called New California, a lot of folks, not just Afghans, read or watch ethnic media.
So you're going to get Chinese language media, you're going to get African American veteran weeklies, you're going to get radio stations in Spanish.
Back in Afghanistan, allegiances and identity are determined by ethnicity and language, Pashtun, Tajik, or Uzbek. Farida Anwari hopes those divisions all fall away as immigrants start to call Fremont home.
That is my aim. That is why I'm still working with the media, to tell people that they're all Afghan.
For On the Media, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon in Fremont, California.
A recent article in U.S. News and World Report detailed the security vulnerabilities of the American trucking industry. It was chock full of detail on how terrorists could hijack dangerous chemicals, smuggle explosives over the border, and so on. A previous story in the magazine similarly exposed security soft spots in the chemical industry. Joining us now is David Whitman, the author of both articles. David, so I'm talking to my brother the other day, and he says to me, hey, why not tell your media pals that loose lips sink ships? He thinks that stories like yours are not only terrifying readers, but giving lots of good ideas to lots of bad people.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who share your Big Brother sentiments, including my father, who raised questions about whether it was really useful to be writing these kind of stories. Jay Leno, a couple weeks ago, quipped only half in jest that he was getting sick of these television networks where there was a reporter standing outside of a water treatment plant, and the reporter's going, you know, and if they poured the poison here, it could wipe out thousands because the guard's off duty from noon until one every day. And Leno's response to the reporter was, shut up.
Do you have that in mind when you're writing a story about, for example, the potential danger of the trucking system?
Sure, and I believe that reporters should do what they can to avoid providing any terrorist targeting tips. I don't think we should be in the business of providing a kind of how-to manual for terrorists.
One of the answers that I've heard to these questions in the past is that, oh, well, all of this information is out there. All you have to do is go to the Internet and scour it and look for this site and that. Does a news weekly like U.S. News have a different responsibility for protecting the common weal than some obscure Internet site?
I think we do, and I think we lived up to it. I'll give you an example of when I worked on the chemical plant security story. I came across one facility that handled extremely hazardous substances that had a memorandum from the Environmental Protection Agency still posted on its website after September 11th, that specifically addressed a part of the facility that was vulnerable to terrorist attack. And the EPA had been assured back in 1998 that this vulnerability would be addressed. When I called the facility, they indicated that they had not yet addressed this vulnerability. Now, I didn't put that in our story, but it's up there on the web. In general, I found it rather horrifying what was up on the web. What was up there before September 11th, some of the information has come down from the web since then, but what was up there before September 11th was a veritable home shopping network for terrorists.
Now, let me ask you this. To what degree does it do my brother or anyone else any good to kind of pretend that this stuff isn't there? Isn't calling the public's attention to potential threats ultimately for the purpose of protecting the society, not for giving bad guys good ideas?
Well, that's how I think of it. It doesn't really do any good to stick your head in the sand about these kind of vulnerabilities, and that's pretty much what the public and journalists and industry and government have been doing for the last several years. In the case of chemical plants, for example, intelligence and security experts have warned for the last 5 years that these plants are vulnerable to terrorist attacks. The same kind of discussions and warnings have taken place about the trucking industry.
So then what's our final message to your father and to my big brother? Is it just shut up?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the final message should be, we hear your concerns. At the same time, it's important to write about some of these vulnerabilities and not pretend that they don't exist and not to pretend that there's not something that can be done about them.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
In the weeks since September 11th, our mailbox has filled with the same concerns we hear on the news and in the polls. Mostly they concern what we should and shouldn't be covering.
Elaine Martin from Seattle was provoked by a metaphor we used likening the coverage of war in its various stages to sports reporting. So, she writes, reporting on war is not unlike reporting on professional sports. No one on this side of the microphone truly believes that war is like football or any other game. She goes on, shallow essays like this one are part of the reason public trust in the media is lower than a snake's testicles. Thank you, Elaine.
The idea that reporters' questions put soldiers at risk came up a lot in your letters. Our interview with a reporter who reads the body language of Pentagon officials moved Peter Lessels of Vermont to write, after listening to David Martin, I think that reporters should only be allowed into news briefings if the military bombs civilians and doesn't fess up or commits other breaches of faith. Then I want to know what units, where they are, their landing, their plans, I can live without knowing.
After hearing Brooke remark on the paucity of reliable information from the government on anthrax and the absence of Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge in the early days of the crisis, Bill Dunning wrote from Allentown, Pennsylvania, I, for one, hope the governor is focused on creating an effective government agency and not Ms. Gladstone's news deadlines. Keep your letters coming and send them to onthemedia@wnyc.org. Don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name.
For the first time in a long time, old-fashioned patriotism seems like an easy sell. Pitching patriotism hasn't always been so simple. Artists and ad men seeking to sell the message of national pride have had to tailor it to fit different audiences. Some old icons retain their freshness, others are discarded and replaced, and the old songs go in and out of style. Our own Mike Pesca explores the commodity that is love of country and what makes people buy it.
Patriotism, Samuel Johnson famously remarked, is the last refuge of the scoundrel. Diderot called patriotism an ephemeral motive that scarcely ever outlasts the particular threat to society that aroused it. To Schopenhauer, patriotism was a dirty fellow who should be thrown out of doors. For more sentiments that seem unfamiliar in these patriotic times, pick up Bartlett's book of familiar quotations. There you'll find dozens of thoughts which range from cautious to downright contemptuous of the notion of patriotism. Even George Washington saw the limitations of patriotism. It was an insufficient premise for a war, he said. And then there's Thoreau. I'll hold on to his quote for later. So what's the common thread among these leading figures of Western civilization who scorned patriotism? They all died before hearing Lee Greenwood.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Nowadays, the songs that are coming from patriotic motivation seem to be more entertaining, it's more interesting, it's more diversified. It's a best example of that is Lee Greenwood's song, Proud to Be an American. It is a great song.
Gary Smith knows patriotic entertainment. He's produced the last four Democratic National Conventions, both Clinton inaugurations, and patriotic TV specials like the Bicentennial of the Constitution. He says when it comes to patriotic fare on TV, there really is no such thing as a cliché. That's why, to a lot of Americans, Celine Dion's rendition of God Bless America during the Tribute to Heroes fundraiser struck a chord, a very loud chord. God Bless America was written in 1918. Along with America the Beautiful, final version 1913, it remains the soundtrack of patriotism. Producer Gary Smith says that patriotic programming stands apart from the rest of television because it's concerned with building a mass audience, not just the 18 to 34-year-old demographic.
The program material that would tend to use patriotic themes, Americana themes, music, would tend to gear to a slightly older audience.
But kids today don't like their messages quite so fruited and plain, which would be fine if their support for the war effort weren't so crucial. Having been fawned over by advertisers for their disposable income, Gen Y now finds itself in the position of being recruited.
This target audience is very informed. They're smart folks, and they're going to get beneath the veneer of just the plain old, you know, God Bless America and really ask tough questions like, what am I going to get out of it?
Ray DeThorne is an account director for the Leo Burnett Advertising Agency in Chicago. He oversees the Army's Army of One campaign, which is designed to appeal to the youth of today. Kids who, DeThorne says, don't think that the Army is all that cool.
Prior to this campaign going on the air, basically what we heard was, if you go in the Army, you either crawl around in the mud or you ride around in a tank. For the people that we're talking to who are 16 to 24-year-old, patriotism is probably latent at best.
The latest Army of One ad is called Generations. It shows a series of sepia-tinged photos of soldiers, leading up to the tagline, "Every generation has its heroes, and this one is no different, Army of One."
It was original music just to kind of pull the emotion out of you. And we stayed around from lyrics, to be honest with you, because I would rather you bring to life what you're feeling as opposed to me trying to tell you what it is that you should be feeling. These people want the substance, not the sizzle, and patriotism is back here, but I don't think that any product or service should really just stand behind the flag. It's ultimately, what are you delivering and how are you adding value?
Uncle Sam will not be pointing his fingers at this generation. Another patriotic icon consigned to the surplus pile of history was created by Massachusetts artist Phil Bissell. In 1959, Bissell, then a sports cartoonist for the Boston Globe, came up with the Minuteman logo for the Boston, now New England, Patriots.
It was very staid, and it appeared as if the guy was digging in and ready to go to work.
For years, Bissell's scowling Minuteman assumed a three-point stance on Patriot helmets. Then, in 1993, the team decided it needed to goose merchandise sales. Out went the Patriot, who looked like he could have served on Uncle Sam's security detail, and in came a vague profile and some suggestive silver streaks designed by the league office.
You see, the new one is really a fast-moving flash on the side of the helmet, for instance, or on the shoulders, that doesn't really depict anything except a very, just a little picture, that's all.
The update sold some jerseys, but tradition-rich symbols such as the old Minuteman, Bissell calls him Pat, are cutting edge these days. At least that's the theory of screenwriter Ed Neumeier. He drew upon 1940s propaganda films like Why We Fight and more recent television images for the movie Starship Troopers, set hundreds of years in the future.
This was kind of inspired by the Gulf War, which was going on right as we started this project. So a lot of this is meant to evoke CNN coverage of the Gulf War.
This bit of media commentary may have been lost inside a tale of space insect warfare, but it was clearly the filmmaker's intention, as the director's track of the Starship Troopers DVD makes clear. Released in 1997, the movie couldn't have commented on the current war, but replaced the phrase giant bug from outer space with finely milled anthrax from Trenton, and you could be watching the Fox News Channel. Starship Troopers ends with one element of patriotic media which we've yet to see during the current war.
One day it will all be over, and everyone will forget that this was the moment. This is when it turned.
Patriotic speech at the end of a movie in the World War II movies, well, every one of them had one.
Ed Neumeier.
And they always kind of ended in an open-ended way. It was assumed that we would keep on fighting and win. And it's always a point in a war where you have to tell your soldiers it's good to die. If you can do that, you can get a lot of good soldiers.
Which brings us back to that Thoreau quote. Writing about the kind of patriot who disregards all judgment, Thoreau wrote, "Some can be patriotic who have no self-respect. They love the soil which makes their graves, but have no sympathy for the spirit which may still animate their clay. Patriotism is a maggot in their heads."
The only good bug is a dead bug.
For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, the Microsoft thesaurus censors itself, and a media mogul makes mayor.
This is that cleverly titled On the Media program from National Public Radio. We seem to be back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As goes Italy, so goes the Big Apple. New York City elected a media mogul this week to succeed the widely celebrated mayor of the nation, Rudy Giuliani. The mayor-elect is Michael Bloomberg, whose campaign had the citizenry shrugging and the pundits chortling just 2 short weeks ago. These are certainly strange times in the city of New York. But it seems especially strange that virtually every political reporter in the city was looking the other way when Bloomberg's ship came in. Having the extraordinary good grace to address this question is Michael Tomasky, political correspondent for New York Magazine. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke, and thank you for not quoting my incorrect prediction back to me in your introduction.
First off, that reference I made to Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's media mogul turned president. I mean, beyond the obvious, he and Bloomberg don't have a lot in common, do they?
I'm sure Bloomberg would insist they don't.
So what sort of challenges or advantages do you think Bloomberg's media empire gives him?
The first and obvious one is the advantage of the wealth that he spent to finance his campaign. He spent, we think, $50 million, might have been $60 million, who knows how much money. And what he managed to do with that money, chiefly, I think, was he managed to create a reality about himself in his television ads that wasn't the reality on the ground in the campaign.
So you're saying that the campaign that the journalists reported on isn't the campaign that the public saw?
That's exactly right. The campaign that the journalists saw was a campaign of a guy who never really got very comfortable on the stump, who as late as 6 days before the election exploded at a Daily News reporter and said some really intemperate things, including a very clear implication that somebody who made $125,000 a year was making chump change. This kind of got buried. The New York newspapers, the Times, and the tabloids were covering, obviously, the war. They were devoting a lot of pages to the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, which is a local story here. They were covering the New York Yankees. By the time you got to a mayoral election coverage, if you were a Times reader, it was on page B5. If you were a reader of one of the tabloids, it was on page 24. And so you didn't see this. You didn't know that Mike Bloomberg wasn't a good candidate and was fairly vague about a lot of his prescriptions for some of the city's problems. But you did see his ads. You couldn't not see his ads, no matter who you were or what you watched on television.
Would you say that the Giuliani ads that were everywhere praising Bloomberg were one of those last-minute factors that no one could have predicted?
Yeah, the Giuliani ads were crucial to Bloomberg's campaign. And again, this is an example of what I was talking about earlier, about the divide between what journalists saw and what regular voters saw. Giuliani waited a long time to endorse Michael Bloomberg. When he finally did it, it was on a Saturday evening. He made Bloomberg and his entourage wait for 75 minutes before Giuliani showed up. And then when Giuliani finally showed up, he was kind of mumbly, and he really wasn't that enthusiastic, and he didn't say anything bad about Mark Green, which everyone expected that he was going to do. So, again, we all had the impression that this Giuliani endorsement was extremely half-hearted and wasn't going to amount to much. In the meantime, they went back to City Hall, I think right after that endorsement, and Giuliani taped this incredibly effective commercial. Watchers of televisions and voters had the impression after they saw this ad 1,800 times that the two guys were best friends.
So how do you assess the job the New York Press Corps did in covering this campaign in general? Did it give a complete and balanced view of the candidates on page B5, even in the New York Times or in the back pages of the Daily News or the New York Post?
In campaigns, reporters and newspapers are somewhat loath to come forward with a lot of original reporting and original analysis on things that either campaign doesn't start. In other words, campaigns have to drive that coverage. Campaigns have to make a statement and make an assertion about the people on the other side that makes reporters go ask the question. Mark Green didn't do that very well against Mike Bloomberg. I don't think Bloomberg did it that well either. One thing I would fault the New York newspapers for is that the investigative reporting took a vacation.
Completely.
Yeah. And there was never really any serious work. This is the first time Bloomberg has been in public life in this way. I mean, he's been in gossip pages and profiled in business magazines, but being a politician invites a new level of scrutiny. But there was never really any serious investigative work done on how he made his money, how he set up his company, you know, why it wasn't a union shop, you know, when it actually invested in South Africa or when it didn't. About the sexual harassment charges that were leveled against him. That made the papers, but only in a sort of piecemeal fashion. There wasn't much investigative work done in this campaign.
Michael Tomasky, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Tomasky is the political columnist for New York Magazine. Thank you. A lot of people, us, have criticized 24-hour television news for hyping recent events in a naked grab for viewers. We know that ratings skyrocketed in the first 2 weeks after September 11th. We don't know if those viewers stuck around and whether they liked what they saw. TV Guide did a survey on precisely those questions. The results are out on Monday, and that's why TV Guide's Max Robbins joins us now. Max, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here, Brooke.
So go through some of those survey results for us.
Well, we found out some very interesting things. We asked which best describes your TV news viewing since September 11th. We found out that 38% said they were watching more news, which doesn't surprise me. In fact, I think I would have expected that number to be higher. 8% said they were watching less. 18% admitted that they were watching more news, but they've cut back as the weeks have gone by. 35%, which I thought was an interesting number, said their TV news viewing hasn't changed at all.
And how do those numbers reflect the Nielsen ratings?
We found after September 11th that news ratings for the all-news networks, for the network news operations, it went through the roof. And it has stayed strong. But we have seen, as we've moved out of that kind of breaking news exclusive period, we have seen it decline. Still, news levels are high. CNN's numbers, Fox's numbers, are probably 2 to 3 times higher than what they are, what they were prior to September 11th.
Now, CNN was number one, finally outstripping Fox in the wake of September 11th. Has that changed?
It has changed. We found out last week, for the first time since September 11th, in primetime, Fox was a little bit stronger than CNN. And that's even given that they're in Fox is in 11 million fewer homes.
Does that suggest that people are ready to go back to the yelling and screaming and aren't looking for breaking news anymore?
Well, I think when you don't have that kind of urgency, when you don't have every day is another big anthrax story, for example, I think that people do kind of drift back into their previous viewing habits and are looking more for that personality, loud, driven talk that Fox has made its bread and butter.
How do people feel about what they've been seeing on television? Is it meeting their needs?
75% are really giving news a vote of confidence. I think 75% is a pretty high mark, given that, look, the news media, TV news media, exactly hasn't been winning any real popularity contests as of late.
What about all we've been hearing about the endless parade of anthrax stories and threats and so on, fomenting a sense of panic? In your survey, did people feel panic?
We asked viewers, have you generally found watching the news to be, A, reassuring? 10% said, yeah, indeed they had. And then we asked, had they found it to be frightening? 13% said yes. Then I think maybe I'd be in this category, Brooke. They said, what about both? And we found 37% said yes, indeed. Then 38% said they found it neither reassuring or frightening.
So this strikes me as an overwhelming lack of consensus.
It does indeed. It does indeed.
You said that 13% of the audience found what they saw to be frightening. Did they keep their kids from watching?
We asked, if you have children under the age of 13, are you limiting the amount of TV news they're watching? Well, it was pretty evenly divided. 51% said yes, indeed, that they were being careful of what kind of images were going to be in front of their children. Let's face it, the news, a lot of the images are quite horrific. 49%, however, said no, they were letting their kids, 13 and under, watch what they were going to watch in terms of news.
I wonder if it's changed people's viewing habits in any substantial way. I remember that after the O.J. trial dominated the airwaves, 10 million new people seem to have been brought to cable. Is there some sort of long legs change that you think is going to come out of what happened after September 11th?
I think that we may find that a young audience, not in any kind of mass numbers, not in the kind of numbers that turn out every Thursday night at 8 o'clock to watch Friends, might be paying more attention, and that there might be some more patience for substantive news.
Well, Max Robbins, once again, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, Brooke, as always, a pleasure to be here.
Max Robbins writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide.
Well,
What do you call it when political correctness meets corporate cravenness and monopolistic business practices? Well, if there's a word for it, you won't find it in the Microsoft Word Thesaurus, which, as a matter of policy, redacts synonyms potentially offensive to computer users. This situation was discovered accidentally by freelance writer Mark Goldblatt, who wrote about his experience in the New York Times. Mark, welcome to the big show.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so you're sitting at your computer, and what happens?
I had typed the word fool in the sentence, only a fool would believe, thought it sounded too much like the Doobie Brothers. So I hit the thesaurus function for the word fool, and I wasn't given a list of nouns that I thought I'd be given.
At this point, you're thinking that, you know, you just have a bad piece of software or something.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking at that point, maybe I should try idiot or imbecile to see if they're synonyms, but those did not have synonyms either. So at that point, I just thought it must be a glitch in my software.
How did you test to find out what's going on?
I called a friend who I knew used Microsoft Word and asked him to try it to see if it was just my computer. But when he tried it with the word fool, he received a list of like a dozen synonyms that completely confirmed that there must be something wrong with my computer.
And then?
Then he was actually the one who said, what version of Microsoft Word are you using? And I was using Word 2000. He was using Word 97. At that point, I think the two of us realized that Microsoft had actually changed the program somehow. And I figured I better call him just to see why this happened.
And lo and behold, they tell you they do it to spare people's feelings. They didn't want to enter the year 2000 in a sea of negativity. What was this all about?
Well, actually, strangely enough, what I started to do when I realized that they had done it to spare people's feelings, I started to try other words that might hurt people's feelings, like short, fat, and ugly. And all of those had long lists of synonyms. So it was really the idiot, imbecile, moron demographic that they were worried about here.
Yes, but is there a danger attached to the company that dominates the word processor market arbitrarily removing words from the language for fear that they might somehow offend somebody?
I think danger is too strong a word. I would say there's an element of silliness about it.
Perhaps danger is too strong a word. What about hazard, risk, peril, threat, menace, jeopardy, or non-safety?
Yeah, I would say there's a non-safety.
Mark Goldblatt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Goldblatt teaches at the Fashion Institute for Technology and is the co-author with Missy Hyatt of The First Lady of Wrestling, an autobiography, out this week. Joining us now from Redmond, Washington, is David Jaffe. He is the lead product manager for Microsoft Office. David, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So, does the Microsoft Word thesaurus really edit for niceness?
Well, not at all. I mean, Word continues to be a great tool. However, at the same time, our approach is to not suggest words that may have offensive uses or offensive definitions.
All right. Well, what constitutes offensiveness?
It's really on a word-by-word basis. I don't have any specific examples for you, but a key for us is to just make sure that inappropriate terms, you know, are removed.
Isn't there something a little bit Orwellian about all of this? I'm thinking specifically of, from 1984, the character Winston Smith, whose job actually was to delete from old newspapers words that have been taken out of circulation by the Minister of Information. Isn't there something a little eerie about all of this?
Not at all. I mean, we've never portrayed Word's dictionary, whether it be the spell checker or the thesaurus, as, you know, a catch-all for every single word. We use it as a tool that helps people create reports, letters, etc.
So you're suggesting because this is only a tool, you've kind of re-engineered it to make sure that the tool isn't misused or abused?
That's correct. I mean, we definitely have a broad user base who uses Microsoft Word, and you know, our goal is to make sure that there's nothing that can be deemed offensive while still making it an extremely useful tool for users as they create their reports, letters, spreadsheets, etc.
David, isn't that the responsibility of the tool user to determine what's offensive and what isn't?
Clearly, we are a tool that helps users communicate their ideas rather than limit those ideas. With that said, however, you know, we do have a broad user base, and it's all about providing a more universally acceptable product for our customers.
And how do you find out what they deem inappropriate?
Well, we receive customer feedback in a variety of different ways. So we take that feedback and we incorporate it into every product version. And so everything we do related to a new version of the product is based on customer feedback.
What's the number of people you have to hear from before a word gets expunged? Is it 400? Is it one? Can one crank with a hair up his probably, well, hold it. With a hair up his donkey, get Microsoft to pull a word out of its lexicon?
Well, there's really no specific number that we can place on it. It's really on an individual by individual basis as to whether something is deemed offensive or inappropriate.
All right. Well, you know, you're not going to concede any of my points, but I very much appreciate your spending the time with us.
Thanks, Bob.
David Jaffe is product manager for Microsoft Office at Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington. Well, look, as long as I have this thing up on my screen, let me just throw some other words in. Microsoft is bad.
Microsoft is good.
Huh. Genius.
Gates.
Bold.
Gates.
Megalomaniac.
Judge Thomas Benfield Jackson.
Gates.
Batman.
Robin.
Paul Allen.
Evil.
Linux.
Monopoly.
Mythological phenomenon. See also Alchemy, Chimera, Easter Bunny.
How about Buxom?
Melinda.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh, Andy Lancet, and Giselle Foss. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And we'd like to say hello to some new stations who have picked up the show: WUNC in Raleigh, North Carolina, KACU in Abilene, Texas, and WFMW in Frostburg, Maryland. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.